for him going down there.
Okay, so we'll start a tape and say here off the top that we are talking today to Marilyn Roy and to her son Eben about their communal experiences. And I guess the first question is, can you just outline where you have been and when? You just tell us a little, just give us a general sense of what you did communally.
Okay. I just want to let you all know that I really was down there for a brief period. I think I went down in May of 76, and Eben was 2 weeks old when we left, and he was born the 28th of July, so we left about the middle of August in 76. And what other information would you like?
Well, now, you went to other communities other than the farm, right?
No, this was the only one. I had other unusual life experiences, but
but they weren't communal.
Not exactly, unless you count. Did you know this, that I traveled with the Royal American Shows and lived on their train? That was rather a communal experience, but that's totally different than you're looking for.
What's the Royal American Shows?
The carnival.
Oh,
they
the
come
carnival.
Every year, you know,
oh, yeah.
Hutchinson
oh, yeah, yeah,
State
yeah.
Fair. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But that was another kind of communal experience, so.
So we're going to look at the farm then mainly, right?
Yes, we're looking at the farm.
Okay. Well, so now how long were you there?
I was there from, I think, the end of May in 76 until the middle of August 76. We do have photographs. They're really old. These were taken on Eben's birthday during a walk shortly before he was born. So we're going to try to get them. I don't know what kind of magic thing you have, but we're going to try to get them so that you guys can see them larger and as a group rather than trying to pass them around. Then I can explain to you what we saw. And Deb can verify since she was just there. Okay.
Well, how'd you first hear of the farm? How'd you get connected?
All right. the midwives here in Lawrence. I had asked, you want me to elaborate?
Yeah.
You'll have to tell me if you want me to elaborate. When I was about 6 months pregnant, I was preparing to have Eben delivered by midwife here in Lawrence, and there was kind of a little midwife community here, and since I was preparing to be a single parent, they thought that it might be a good idea for me to go down and have Eben on the farm rather than here in this community, because they thought that maybe I could get a better view, you know, of what it was like to parent, and also kind of get a good idea about whether or not I was really prepared enough, you know, to be a single parent. And they thought that they were too close to me, you know, and they wanted me to have a more objective delivery. And since that time, I've rethought the whole thing and wished I would have stayed here, but that was how I found out. They said, well, there's this place down in Tennessee, and they'll deliver your baby for free, and the midwives are great, and, you know, and there's, like, lots of children and community, and it's probably the perfect place for you to go. And so I said, okay.
So you ended up in Summertown at the farm.
Yes, now, I was driven down there by two real close friends. You might have known of them, Edgar Bowles.
Yeah.
Edgar Bowles, my two architect friends, and Bill Judy drove me down.
Now, were you just welcomed with open arms when you got there? Were they anxious for people to come, or did they say, oh no, not another one?
No, they didn't have that reaction. Actually, it was very low key. I mean, you know, we had corresponded ahead of time. And I may even still, I should have dug in my letters. I probably still have the letters, you know, that I exchanged with the midwives. I wrote to the farm and asked them if it would be all right if I came, and got hooked up with one of the midwives there. And I also may have corresponded with Ina May. I don't really remember, but I got permission to come, and we set a date. And they had prepared a place for me in one of their tents, one of their house tents. And so when I got down there, we drove right to the tent where I was to stay. Actually, I think this little, you guys, that's why I want these pictures to get bigger, but the first place I stayed, I was there temporarily just for a couple of weeks, and it was just a real small little house tent, probably, you know, maybe a 1.5 bedroom with kind of a rigged up kitchen, you know, and a kind of a jerry-rigged bathroom, and I don't think there was running water, but I'm not positive about that. And then after it was really crowded in that little place, so then I got moved to a much larger place. It was faced off by a meadow where they had all of their communal services on Sunday. And I actually moved into the midwife's house where I stayed for the rest of the time. So, yeah, they were very, it was just kind of like, well, here's another person come to live with us. It was really no big deal.
Well, let me push a particular thing I'm particularly curious about.
All right.
The farm, when we first met and I first heard your story, the farm was still relatively young, still relatively new, and still big and booming and thriving.
Uh-huh.
And I had heard basically nothing but absolutely glowing positive reports on it. But I remember you saying, well, it wasn't perfect. It had some shortcomings. So what were some of your reactions? What didn't seem like it would be ideal to you?
You want me to tell the truth?
Yeah, sure.
Really? Do you guys want to really hear about this? Well, I had real mixed feelings about being there, because on the one hand, it was actually my first real communal experience. I'd never been in that kind of situation before, where I'd lived among a group of people who were trying to live cooperatively, and I had come to them out of the cooperative movement here in Lawrence, because I was one of the first members of the mercantile and one of the first members of the credit union, and you know, and I really enjoyed participating in the community, our community, you know, as a cooperative community at that time. So I was accustomed to the philosophy, but I never lived in a large group of people like that, and so it was, you know, it was a new experience for me, seeing how people got along in that kind of a situation. And while I was there, it had its positive aspects. I mean, everybody was vegetarian. They only ate what they grew, with the exception of white sugar and black tea. Those were the two things. They'd go into town, come back with large quantities of white sugar, and all the guys that worked out there, you know, they pretty much thrived on their black tea with white sugar while they were out there working in the fields, you know, digging up their beans or whatever. And, you know, people really did, you know, work together to help each other out. I mean, each house had an established routine of, you know, divided labor, and, you know, the men would mostly, it was interestingly enough, the men would get up and go out in the day, work in the fields, you know, either planting the crops or, you know, or at that time it was harvest time. I remember beans was what we were picking at the time, and green peppers. And, you know, they would go out and work with the crops, and basically the women would stay on the farm around the homes, tending to the children, you know, and kind of doing the like wifely and motherly duties while the men went out and did the hard labor. And, you know, I accepted that. That didn't give me a problem. And there was a period of time when because I was there as a temporary person, the agreement that you make when you go is that you will participate as a resident of the farm. You will do the work. You know, you will live in the home, you will be just as a resident would be, and in exchange for what you give, then they deliver your child for free and you can stay there for free. So I would go out in the bean fields and pick beans instead of staying back, you know, and tending with the children. And that was fine. But on the other hand, you know, there were, and they really lived their principles. You know, they had a soy dairy, which you know, it was a nice big building, really clean. You know, you could go in. I love doing this. First thing in the morning, people love to get up and go to the soy dairy, and out of this big steel canister would come this fresh, cold soy milk. You just take your little glass, you know, and get yourself a glass of soy milk. And they had a cooperative store, which Deb says they still have, and they, you know, they'd put all of the stuff that came in from the fields and the stuff that you couldn't, you know, that they would get from town, like cleaning supplies and stuff, and people would just go in and take what they wanted and leave. That was really nice, you know, and they had a granary, they grew their own grain, they ground it there, baked their own bread, you know, all the food was made from scratch, incredible food. That was all really, really nice and really good, but the sanitation was poor at the time. They had problems at one point, they had health problems because of it, and it was just kind of at the time it was just kind of like, where they were at in their consciousness, you know, because they had a person that they were funding. They were putting this person through medical school so that they would have an on-the-farm doctor. And they had a person that had already graduated from nursing school, and she was the on-the-farm nurse, and they had a nice little health clinic right there on the farm. And I remember when Eben, right after Eben was born, he turned blue, and we had to put him under a bilirubin light, and there was this clinic actually had, I don't know if you know what that is, but it's like an ultraviolet light, and if a child is born and their liver isn't quite working right, then you put them under this light and they stay there until, you know, they turn the right color, and then you take them out. But anyway, you know, they had a nice little clinic, and it had a good little staff of people who knew what they were doing. They had the modern technology. They had an ambulance on site at the farm. They still have this really good, you know, system that way. But on the other hand, they didn't have bathrooms indoors at all. They had an outdoor set of bathrooms that I think was not roofed. It was like stalls, you know, in any public restroom.
An outhouse.
An outhouse. Yeah. A big outhouse. Yeah.
Multi-stall and, outhouse.
Yeah. Okay. That was it. Okay. Exactly. A multicellular outhouse. And it was unfortunate because they were trying to feed the farmhands from a centralized cookhouse where the women would go during the day, and in the middle of the day they'd make a giant lunch and all the guys would come in, you know, and they'd eat their like soy burgers or whatever, you know, and then go back out and work. And because the sanitation was not up to par, there was a big sickness that went around the farm while I was there. Flies would come from the outhouse and then fly into the cookhouse and then, yeah, and land on people's food, and a lot of people got sick, and a lot of children were really sick, and they ended up closing down that kitchen for a long time. The health people came and did an inspection and required them to put up screens, and, you know, they had to make some changes in the way that they were doing things while I was there because they just didn't have that kind of consciousness. I think they just really didn't think it was necessary, you know. And that was one thing, you know, it was interesting to watch, you know, but hard for me to watch was there were a couple things that were going on that were more interesting still, and that was that it seemed like while I was there, there was kind of a division between, there was kind of two camps. One camp were really devoted to Stephen Gaskin, and the other camp were not devoted to Stephen Gaskin. And those two camps were fighting and arguing, and people were starting to leave. And people were moving out of houses and changing locations and kind of, you know, grouping up with one another according to, you know, what they thought about Stephen's lifestyle and his value systems and his beliefs. And, you know, and since I was an outsider, I just kind of watched it all, you know, and didn't really get involved. But it was uncomfortable, you know, because what was going on there was not my idea of communal living, but I guess it was actually what communal living is probably really like. You probably know a lot about this.
There's
you
a lot
know,
of
from
conflict.
Your research. Yeah.
But let me just pursue that a moment. There was a sizable anti-Stephen faction?
Well, it was sizable enough that it got discussed in the household that I was living in. I can't say, you know, really how much more sizable it was than that. But there were people in my household, even couples. It was dividing couples. I remember this, that there were a couple of couples, one in particular, that she was, I think she was pregnant along with me, and her husband were living in two different households because their disagreement upon, you know, and the leadership was so high. I'd forgotten all about this, but
But I thought a basic bottom line of living at the farm was you had to accept Stephen as your teacher.
Well, that was supposed to be a basic bottom line, but, you know, people move in and they get together and they talk and, you know, they learn about each other and, you know, and it wasn't some, I mean, you know, he didn't find people going out to the meadow on Sunday morning, you know, and carrying placards against Stephen, you know, it wasn't that, but, you know, just, it was just like probably any other place where people get together under a leadership and then they start, you know, having feelings about what's going on there and they start really thinking about it clearly and, you know, just changing, you know. But I think I'll tell you something that was the hardest thing for me, really. I mean, the political stuff was interesting. The sanitation stuff was real interesting. And actually, that was kind of rewarding to watch because they did something about it. Once they understood, you know, what was needed, they took care of it. But the thing that I found the hardest, actually, and ironically enough, was the child care system that they had. And I think I talked with you about this a long time ago. Do you remember?
Yeah, go ahead. And
is it okay?
Please. Sure, yeah.
Well, it was harder. Being down there and being pregnant was probably, you know, if I was going to make an objective decision, you know, about being a mother, is the worst place you could send someone because probably, you know, half the women were pregnant and the other half that weren't pregnant had either just delivered or, you know, they had toddlers running around. So, you know, being completely surrounded by children and pregnant women, if you're a pregnant woman, well, you know, you're the... You're going to go ahead and you're going to have your baby and you're going to, you know, you're going to keep that baby and there's no question about it. But they had a discipline policy that really upset me, and that was that, you know, they were real laissez-faire with their kids, you know. I mean, they were pretty loose with the discipline. And on the other hand, I have vivid memories of waking up in the night to tiny babies crying and the parents putting the babies outside in a crib and letting them cry alone, you know, until they got over it. And they seemed to have this notion, you know, that even at a very young age, children were conscious of their behavior and could control it. And, you know, and they thought that, you know, that if they left the child alone long enough, that they would grab the idea that no crying for a long period isn't, you know, isn't appropriate, and, you know, they'd get over it. And there were, you know, and I thought, you know, that was really cruel. I thought that was really, you know, not child-focused or centered at all. I thought it was a really weird thing for them to do, considering, you know, how pro-child they were supposed to be. And I don't know, you know, what it's like up there now. I don't know if their discipline policies have changed. I don't know if children live there anymore. They also had their own school. School still operating?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had their own school, you know, on the property, and they educated their children right there, and it was probably like a big homeschool. You get the impression it was kind of like a big homeschool.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the education part was taken care of, but I just thought that they were, it just seemed like maybe, you know, maybe there's a point in time where everybody just wanted to, like, not have the children around, and that was kind of how they dealt with it. And also, you know, and Eben was just a week old. Being a new mother, it's just a different experience. You're very protective of your child, and, you know, and of course, most of the women there were breastfeeding. Not very many of them were bottle feeding, and the ones that were bottle feeding because they couldn't breastfeed. On the other hand, you know, when the baby's a week old, they want to start giving them cereal. I'll never forget that. I'll never forget the time that, you know, the midwife said, well, he's crying because he's hungry. And I'd say, no, he's not hungry. I've just fed him. And they'd go, yeah, he's hungry. Let's give him some cereal. And I'd say, my baby can't have that silver spoon in his little mouth. He's too young. I mean, you know, but, I mean, it was, they had real interesting ideas about, you know, about feeding the children too as well. I mean, they introduced them to solid food at a really young age, and I didn't think that was appropriate either. But I don't know. You know, looking back, I was young, I was naive, I was idealistic. You know, it was a new and different experience, one unlike I'd never had before, and I probably, you know, don't really have any right to, you know, express opinions about it, because it was a time and a place, you know. It was the middle 70s, you know. And what else do you want to know?
what were the Sunday services like? You must have gone to some of those.
I only remember one really vividly. I tended to avoid them because I personally didn't like Stephen very much.
That's a basic problem.
The service was him. Everybody would go out and gather in this meadow, and then Stephen would come and speak. And I remember being in the meadow, and I remember seeing him up there, and, you know, I remember this really religious feeling that permeated the crowd, you know, as they listened to him. But I just wasn't real taken with him as a leader. He seemed to be kind of the guru of the group, and those who accepted that was fine. But it was beautiful outdoors. You know, everybody came as they wanted to. You know, came just dressed in ordinary clothes, and he would talk, and then they didn't sing. I think they held hands in a circle afterwards and kind of blessed each other for the day, and then they went off and did mushrooms. And that's what I remember of the Sunday service. You know, they... I'm sorry, I can't report more, but...
Elaborate on the mushrooms a little bit. Of course, the farm was famous for its psychedelic outlook. That was kind of really basic to Stephen's teaching, wasn't it? Did he talk actively about psychedelics?
He probably did, but like I said, I really tried to avoid any encounter with him. All I know about him is what I heard from the people that I lived with. And he was proactive on psychedelics, but the one thing that I can report that I really do remember is a day in particular, that same day that I went to the service, coming back and finding out that they kept these psychedelic mushrooms in a special place in their communal refrigerator. That was another thing they had. Do they still have that? The communal walk-in, you know, where everybody keeps their cold things, you know? Well, they had a communal walk-in, and there was a certain secret place where they kept their mushrooms, and only those who lived on the farm could participate. So if you were a visitor, you did not do the psychedelic mushrooms along with the farm residents, because they felt like, you know, it was sacred to them, and also they didn't know if you would be able to handle the effects of it, and they weren't going to take any chances of anyone, you know, coming in from the outside and having a bad experience, so... But I
pregnant women who lived at the farm take mushrooms?
You know, I'm trying to remember that, and it does seem to me that the pregnant women didn't. But it also seems to me that the nursing mothers could if they chose. But I could be wrong about that. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't.
What do you have to say about the child discipline practices? Did you see good care being given in basic?
Well, frankly, I didn't see that many kids when I was there. I'm mainly adults, but, you know, maybe it may have been because the kids were in school. I don't know. I mean, I saw some teenagers, but I didn't see any young kids. Do you think that the vegan diet was good enough for a woman who's pregnant?
Why do you ask?
I'm just curious. I don't know. I'm just curious what you think.
Well, I'll tell you, at the time, this is a funny story. At the time, I loved the food and still do. I mean, you know, I would highly recommend this cookbook to anyone because everything that's in it is just like your mom made when you were a kid, only it's vegan. But it tastes. I mean, the chicken fried steak tastes like chicken fried steak, but there's no chicken in it, you know. However, I thought it lacked in a lot of nutrients. And by the time he was born, I was dying to get home and have some good food to eat. I mean, it wasn't that I didn't have good food to eat, but I was really hungry for meat. That's what I remember, you know. I was really hungry for meat, and also the fact that they only ate the vegetables in season. and they didn't ever import anything else, you know, from outside. So, you know, if the apples weren't available, then there were no apples. And, of course, they didn't have citrus groves or anything, so you didn't have citrus fruit. And, you know, because they only would eat what was growing on the farm and in season, there was a lot of, I thought, a lot of nourishment that was lacking, because you just made do with what was available at the time on the, you know, on the farm. So, no, I didn't think that it was adequate myself. But their belief, if you read the cookbook especially, and also if you read, I don't know if this book is still available anymore, do you have a copy of the midwifery book?
Oh, that's,
the one where the
that's
midwifery...
That's very much available, yeah.
Is that still available?
It's in about fourth or fifth edition now.
Is it really? I wish I had a copy. Tell me where I can get one, because I want to get one. But
At the Merck,
I think. At the Merck carries it. They really highly recommend the use of, I mean, you know, the basis of their diet is soy, and they grow their own soybeans. And they highly recommend, you know, massive use of soy in every form. And they say that most of the necessary nutrients, vitamins and minerals, especially iron and calcium, I think, that you know, that a nursing woman, pregnant woman needs, are available in the soy products. And since the soy products are so high in protein, they never worry about protein. But I thought a lot of trace minerals were missing, and you know, since we have a wide array of other kinds of vegetables and fruits available to us here that weren't available there, especially sea, I felt sea was really missing in that diet. But that was just me, you know. I came home and started eating meat right away. And my friend, I remember that my friend Molly came up to be with me during the time when for Eben's birth, and she took these pictures, and I remember she smuggled in peanut butter and oranges and apples, you know, and we were instructed if anyone came to visit us, you know, and off the farm, and we got food, hide it under our beds because everybody would be wanting it, you know. So I did that.
Well, you know, a couple of the people I talked to said that they didn't get enough food, and they were always hungry. So did pregnant women get extra food?
It seems like yes. It seems like yes, but once again, you know, the type that was available, I mean, there were a lot of tortillas and a lot of beans, you know, and you could eat up on those as much as you wanted, you know. A lot of flour products available. But I was just, I felt like the food was plenteous, but just, I was just hungry for fruit and vegetables and juices and things. But maybe it's different though. How big is the farm now, and like what do they grow?
Well, there's 100 people, but they don't eat together communally. They just have private households.
So does everybody have their own garden?
You know, I don't even know that.
Pretty much, yeah.
I think so. You've been down there to visit too, since a couple times, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are your observations? How can you compare what I've been telling you to? To what's going on?
We're looking at what happened in 76. That's years before I was ever there.
You okay?
Mm-hmm.
You embarrassed with any of this?
Let me just one more question about the mushrooms. Now they were in a refrigerator, and you could just go get them anytime if you were a farm member. I mean,
only on Sundays.
Only
it was
on
very
okay.
closely okay. monitored. There was one person, I believe, in each household who was the designated mushroom getter. You know, and then they really, I remember they had a whole ritual around it, you know, where they laid them out and they cut them up, you know, and each person got a piece and ate them. I watched this all. I don't know. But it's funny. I remember this because I hadn't remembered this for years. But now I can see it all, you know, each person taking their piece and then, you know, sitting for a while, you know, and then kind of waiting for the effect to come on, you know. And then everybody gets really giddy and happy and they all start talking to each other, you know, and then some of them kind of wander out, you know, and have their own experience out on the meadow or whatever, but you know, they really had a ritual and a ceremony around it, you know, and it, for them it was a pleasurable experience, but definitely it was supposed to be a religious experience.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that. I mean, I had this vision of everyone working stoned all day out in the field.
No, only on Sunday afternoons after the religious service had been held.
These crooked rows.
Yeah.
That I don't know. I personally have never taken them. So I don't even know what it's like. And of course, I didn't really want to inquire into their sources. It wasn't really any of my business to either. We were really supposed to just stay out of that. You know?
Now, they ate a really pure, clean, vegan, organic diet, except white sugar. That's a rather huge gaping hole in
there. Oh, yeah, and it's all through the cookbook. You know,
white sugar,
you know, the whole sweet section is, yeah, white sugar. Oh, yeah.
So, were they pretty nuts about white sugar?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, that was their big treat. The other thing they would bring back, I remember, was candy. The kids got candy. They'd bring back white sugar and candy from town.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the kids would go to town and get candy.
The kids would stay home, and the parents would go to town and bring candy back for the kids. Yeah. Yeah.
How did they? Oh, well, go ahead.
What was the relationship between the farm members and the town?
God, that's something I haven't thought about for a long time either. Instinctively, I feel to say mixed. But you'll have to give me a little bit of time to try to get those memories back. It seems that there were people, that the town was Summertown, real small town. Is it still a little?
Yeah, it's still tiny.
Yeah. And it seemed that they were pretty well accepted. This is just instinctive, okay, you guys? I don't know if you know what instinctive memory is, but you know, it seems that the Summertown people, the hippie culture there, pretty well accepted the members of the farm. It seemed like that people who were more straight maybe had some problems with it being there, but I'm not sure. It just seems that's my instinctive answer. What do you think about that? From everything you've heard?
I think they had troubles at first, but got more and more friendly. By the time you were there, they were probably on pretty good terms with their neighbors. That's my impression.
Yeah? Okay.
I'm curious to follow up a few more things about just what daily life was like. Now, they cooked centrally. There was one big kitchen that fed all of these hundreds and hundreds of people. Is that right?
There were kitchens in the farm tents and farmhouses for the families that lived there. And the families, by the way, could be any number from 8 to 25. The central kitchen was designed to feed the farmhands and only served lunch.
I see. So you had breakfast and dinner out in your house? Whatever.
Yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
How many people lived in a typical house? What was the house like? Yours was a tent?
Ours was called I lived in the farm tent. And that was the main house on the farm.
Was it a tent?
Well, it's like Deb was describing earlier. It was, I have a picture. It's so hard to see because Molly's flash wasn't working. So we only have pictures of the outside of the places, but here you can see this part was a tent. This part was tent part in which they'd installed like floor-to-ceiling windows, and that was the living room. It was part tent and part house, and the house would be a wooden structure. Now this is this is the farm. I'm thinking this is the soy dairy, but I'm not quite sure. But if you guys can see these wooden structures, they would build out of like, it looked like weathered pine. And so the one that I was living in, the farm tent, was like half of a big circus tent and then half of a wooden structure built out of this kind of weathered pine. And it seemed that they had cement flooring, all of them did. And there were a few that were real houses that looked kind of like this. You know, small homes, but most of them were tents or half tent, half house. And the average number of people I'd say were maybe 10. Like the first one, like I said, that I started out in was maybe 7 or 8. And then the largest one was the one that I was in, and there were, I think, 25 people in that one.
And were you piled in pretty tightly?
The smaller ones, people were packed in. And when I moved to the larger house, I remember I was up on a second floor, kind of a deck that they had built, and I actually slept on the floor side by side with men and women, you know, pregnant and non-pregnant, in sleeping bags. Huh. And then when it came close to time for the birth, well, then there was a birthing room with a bed. But yeah, they kind of had it arranged so that couples, there was like, I remember a couple's tent where only couples lived. And then there was a singles tent where only singles lived. And then there were like a couple of places, like this house that I was living in, where couples and singles lived together. And then the pregnant women came to be, because that particular house was owned by one of the midwives. Have you heard this before?
Hmm.
No. This is true. I really remember this.
Okay.
I'm seeing this clearly. It's just been so long, you know. But now here's an example of a house in progress, a real house. This was, at the time that I was there, the only house. It actually had siding on it, you know, like aluminum siding. And the clinic did as well. That was a really nice structure. What else would you like to know? These pictures will tell a lot.
Okay. What sort of structure does Stephen live in?
I never saw it. It was sort of I remember his place was separate from the rest of us, and it was kind of out in the backwoods. That's what I knew about it. It was this place that was out in the backwoods where he lived with Ina May and possibly one other woman. That was just a rumor that was going around. And it seemed like it was a largish residence that most of us, even the people that were regular residents on the farm, did not go visit very often. Is this correct?
Yeah,
I think they were really protective of their privacy, it seems to me. Is that not correct?
I went to his house, and it was originally an army tent, and then they built a house around it, so you can still see portions of the tent structure as part of the house. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's nothing special. I mean, I thought maybe the guru would have a really wonderful special house, but he didn't.
Yeah, I didn't get the impression that they had anything that was much better or more than anyone else. But the impression was that we were to respect their privacy. We didn't just go over and visit them any time.
Then what was the nature of his day-to-day involvement in the commune?
Well, what would you say? I'd say kind of the administrator, kind of the overseer. Kind of, what would you say?
I don't know. Did he go work in the fields?
I don't know about that. I don't think so.
Did he do it?
I think he kind of made sure that everything was running smoothly. I mean, they had so many business operations. I remember they had this man, the business manager was named Wayne. And I think that he stayed in the house with Eben, and not with Eben, I'm sorry, with Stephen at the time. And that they worked real closely together to make sure that the soy dairy and the book company and the granary all were working smoothly. And they had this, tell them about that. It seems to me that Stephen and Ina May were both real heavily involved in that charitable organization that you were telling me about earlier. Uh-huh. Yeah, it seemed like that's where his special interests lie, and if he gave physical energy to and attention to anything, that it was particularly that.
What about other daily realities? How they handle laundry for hundreds of people?
Oh, well, that's a good, I can show you. they had a laundromat. Let me see. Okay, here's a picture of laundry hanging out, and I think this is the laundry building. This was very interesting. I have very vivid memories of this. All of the laundry was taken in white pickle buckets. Groups of women would gather the laundry together. This was really the hardest part about this, but the most interesting part about this was the diapers. You know, all the babies wore cloth diapers. The whole farm was in cloth diapers because, of course, they wouldn't use anything like Pampers. So on laundry day, for every house, a group of the women would get together, and all of us would lug these incredibly heavy, sloshy, buckets full of wet, dirty diapers, and then other women would carry the baskets with the regular clothes up to the house that was the laundromat. And it was just like any other laundromat, except you didn't put coins in the machines. They had several washing machines, large industrial types, and large industrial dryers. And once a week, the people from each, you know, like each house would go to the laundromat and do its laundry and then bring it back. And some of the people didn't use the dryers, so a lot of laundry ended up getting brought back sopping wet in these same buckets. We'd wash the buckets out, you know, and then put it all back in there and then bring it all out. And there were just laundry lines everywhere, you know, like every house had strings and strings of lines, and people would hang their laundry out. And that's how the laundry was done. All these hippie women walking down the road, you know, in their little dresses and their scarves around their heads, carrying the baskets. Yeah.
Sounds like something out of the third world or something.
There were some third world, you know, parts about the farm. Kind of interesting. Yeah. What else?
You make it sound like all of the labor was divided along very classic sex roles. Is that right? You talk about women cooking and doing laundry and men working out in the fields.
Well, that was pretty much the case.
Was it?
Yes, it was pretty much the case. There were a few women who would go out and work in the fields with the men. But for the most part, yeah, it was a real classic dichotomy. And it seems to me that that was one of the arguments that was going on there at the time. That was one of the problems. There were people who disagreed with those policies, seems to me.
But somebody set up the schedule and said, you do this and you do this.
Well, they had house meetings. So within each house, you know, the work schedule was arranged among the residents of the house or the tenant.
So it wasn't just a given. I mean, people had input into what they might.
It wasn't like, you know, Stephen gathered the whole farm together and divided up the men and the women and said, you know, the men are going to do this and the women are going to do that. I think that was just, you know, that male-female division of labor. I don't really know what that had, how that came about, but that was just kind of the common accepted policy on the farm. But then within each house, you know, they had regular weekly house meetings where they would sit down and talk about what was going to go on.
Were you accountable to anybody, like getting it done?
Me, myself, or anybody in general?
People in general,
No, it's pretty much a trust system. You know, there weren't like star charts or checkoff boards or, you know, anything like that where you made sure that everybody did their job. It was pretty much a trust system.
And it worked.
It worked fairly well, as a matter of fact. Yeah, it did, I thought.
Are there any people you especially remember as just, you know, memorable folks, either good or bad? Anyone you couldn't stand?
Anyone I couldn't stand? Yeah, it seemed like there were a couple of women in our house that I personally couldn't stand. That and one of them, it turned out almost nobody in the house could stand, and she ended up leaving. But I don't remember anyone's names except the woman. There was a woman who you can't see. She was in this woman. I think her name was Lois. Was a slender, tallish woman who I think was like a long-term temporary resident of the farm. And she and I got to be real good friends and real close to each other. She had birthed her baby shortly before I got there. That was the deal. And I mainly remember her because we got along so well, and there were a lot of the people there that I was uncomfortable around, you know. It was a different group of people, but she and I had a lot in common. We became real good friends, and the thing about her was that right when I was going, I'm embarrassed to talk about this stuff in front of a group of people, but so I apologize to you all. I'm not comfortable talking about labor and birth in front of groups, but. Okay. But I took the day that Eben was to be born, my friend Molly and I went out for a long walk around the farm, and I showed her everything, and we took all these pictures. And we came back, I was real tired, and someone said, well, you know, you're going to have your baby pretty soon. And this woman gave me my first and last toke on a joint and said, here, smoke this, it'll relax you. And and it did. And he was born about 5 hours later, but... Oh, you're embarrassed, aren't you? No. I don't blame you in the least if you want to walk out right now.
It's a handy painkiller.
Well, anyway, most of the people there were just, you know, they were just farm people, you know. And, yeah, there were some strong personalities, and there were some not-so-strong personalities. And there were people that were really proactive, and there were people that were pretty laid back.
Do you remember your midwife?
You betcha. And I have her picture here, but once again, unfortunately, it's dark. I mean, it was inside. Yes, my midwife was Mary Fierstadt. And Mary and Paul Fierstadt were the owners of this house, lived in this house. Are they still living there? Mary and Kara were twins, and they were both midwives on the farm. They were the head midwives on the farm, right underneath Ina May. Were they still living there?
I don't know. There's a couple hundred people there, so I don't know.
You don't know? Yeah, they had two little boys that were really sweet. And one of these, I've remembered their names, and then I forget them. But yeah, she was wonderful.
How were conflicts managed? Day-to-day conflict. You said that there was a house meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Every week, every day.
Seemed like that they also had their house meetings on Sundays.
After the psilocybin.
Yeah. In the evening. In the evening. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I can't really speak for that. The conflict management, it doesn't stand out as an experience that's strong for me that I remember. My gut reaction would be to tell you that probably most conflicts were managed by within the house meeting, within the structure of the house meeting. And if there was something really serious that came up, you know, they would probably delegate it to the individuals involved and send them off to have a private conference, you know, and get it settled then. But, you know, in-house, it seemed like most of their conflicts were resolved within the house meetings.
Question?
Will you? Good.
No.
The first part of your question I can't answer. I don't know about that. I don't know whether new mothers were exempt from communal labor. I mean, the communal labor that women did wasn't much more than, you know, like I said, household duties and taking care of children anyway. So I don't, you know, it wouldn't have been that stressful. But I really can't... I can't answer you on that for sure. All I can tell you is that, yes, there was a communal nursery. There was a period of time when the mother herself took care of the child herself, and no one else was expected to, or even in certain cases allowed to, you know, share the responsibility. But there's a certain point where, you know, a child came to be of a certain age, and then the child became a group of responsibility of the group, you know. There was really a real communal parenting system that they had set up, and part of that did take place in the communal nursery.
And by group, are you speaking more of the household group, or the farm as a larger, was there a huge nursery that served everyone in the farm, or did members within the house take care of the children?
Well, it seems, I remember that there was a large community nursery building, a building, and I have a picture of the playground where I'd forgotten about this too until just now, but there were people that lived on the farm that would work in town. And when that was the situation, if one or the other parents was working in town and then another parent was on the farm doing something else, the child would go to the nursery if they were too young to attend the school. Within the households, there was also community care set up for the children. If the child was, I think that, that the thing with the nursery was that the child would, I think it seemed like age two and above, perhaps this is incorrect, but between two and five, the child could go to the community, the larger community nursery, and then between birth and two, I think that the arrangement was that the child would stay within the household, and members of the household would either trade off or share care for the child while the mother would go do what she needed to do. Is this sounding familiar to you?
Yeah, I don't know. It's new to me.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, you visited so much, I thought
you
probably
Yeah, but later. It was all a lot later.
Oh, okay.
After they decentralized.
I'm pretty sure that that's the system. When Eben was born, I had the midwife right there with me in the house. And all of the people, you know, and everyone there, all of the women there were immediately interested in him and in sharing his care and in instructing me about how to take care of him. You know, they're all real open with their, you know, with their parenting knowledge and instruction and want to help you as much as they can. So I guess that's a lot what I mean, too, by the community orientation. Different individual parents, of course, had their own child-rearing ideas and methods, and some of those, depending, it seemed like, on the size of the household, had a lot to do with how much the individuals were asserting their own ideas, you know, about child-raising and about marriage and about employment as well.
I want, before we get too far, to just ask Eben a question, if I can.
Please
just,
do.
I mean, I presume that you don't have any active memories of the farm, right? I mean, you were,
exactly.
What, 3 months old or something when you left?
Yeah. He was 2 weeks.
Two weeks,
he
okay.
He was 2 weeks.
But I just wonder, has this come back into your life in any later way?
Well, you know, if I ever get to the point where I'm sitting down and telling someone about my whole life experience, then it'll come up that I was born on a commune farm, of course, and the reaction to that is usually snickers, and, you know, elbow nudging, hippie boy, you know, things like that. But it's never really caused a problem for me because I, you know, this is the first time I'm hearing about most of this stuff too, and I forgot to tell you that. I'm perfectly, blissfully uneducated about all of this, and so I really can't go into any detail with anybody, and so
we should have prepped ahead of time.
Flashcards or something.
I publicly apologize to you for not prepping you ahead of time about this. You're welcome.
Have you ever run into any other farm babies?
No, I never have.
Because there have been thousands of them.
I wish that would happen. Have you met people that...
Only when I've been there.
Really?
I think.
I came across the...
I don't know anyone else.
The...
something?
The midwifery book, though, a while ago, and I had no idea that the farm was such a big deal. You know, I thought that it was just some little... tiny, isolated community among thousands of commune farms in the middle 70s, you know. And so when I came across this book, I started leaping through. I wonder if I'm in this, you know. And I got the whole...
Your birth certificate's made out from Summertown.
Yeah, I know.
It is.
I got the whole gist and the feel on the farm at that point. That was about it. That was a couple years ago.
That's so neat. Do you have that? You didn't have that before.
No, one of my friends had it.
I've looked for your pictures in different farm publications. There's one woman in the farm cookbook who I knew at the time there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What else? What are we missing, Deborah? What else should we be asking?
Do they use the term ladies?
Yes.
Did that feel odd to you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It felt odd and it felt kind of good at the same time because I knew that it was a term of respect you know, that was given to the women by the men. But it also really, what's the opposite of underplayed? You know what I mean?
Exaggerated.
Yeah, or kind of, whatever the opposite word for underplayed is, it really played up that division, you know, between the male and the female and their ideas of males and men and women at that time to me. Why do you ask that question? Do they still call them ladies?
Yeah, it was just odd for me to go to a place that felt like a hippie commune and have them use the word lady. It just felt odd.
Yeah, and my old man. Yeah, mm-hmm. Do they call them old men mm-hmm. still? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, after Eden was born, you stayed 2 weeks and then you left. Was that your own choice, or did they ask people to leave at that point?
I could have stayed probably as long as I wanted to. And I was actually pretty eager to get home right after he was born, but he was 2 weeks early. And they had a rule that you didn't leave the farm with your baby until he was up to his appropriate birth weight for term. So that's why we waited 2 weeks, so that he could get up to his appropriate birth weight.
So it wasn't ever the type of place that you would have liked to have stayed or lived long term?
You know, different time, different place. Perhaps if I would have had grown up in an environment where, you know, community was appreciated, I probably would have loved the farm a lot more and wanted to stay there for a real long time. But I didn't have that kind of background coming in and was still pretty straight-laced. I mean, relatively speaking, you know, compared to the people that were living there. Even with my, you know, community background from here in Lawrence, I felt like I was more conservative than a lot of the people that were living there. So, no, I didn't want to stay. But I've often thought back, I've wanted to go back and visit so often, and wondered if now I wouldn't be comfortable living there, because I really have become a community person, you know, now, since that time.
Do you have any feel for why the farm has lasted as long as it has? I mean, it's no longer fully communal, but it certainly still exists as a community, and, you know, much longer than most commons of its time period. Do you have any feel for that?
Well, you know, you'd probably be a better person to answer that question than I, because I have very little information on other existing communes. I've done very little reading on that, and I've never visited another one. So I really think that maybe you could answer that question better, just from having you and Tim together, from having seen what you've seen more recently. I can't guess.
One of the things that Ina May said to me was she felt that the home birthing that was going on there was really the glue that held the community together. It really brought people together. Do you think that's true?
I would agree with that at the time that I was there, most mm-hmm. definitely. Yes. I mean, you know, the number of pregnancies, you know, that were happening at that time, and the number of women, I mean, someone, it seemed like, was going into labor nearly every day, you know. It was amazing. And, you know, the spirituality, the level of spirituality that was around birthing at the farm at that time was so high. And they really saw it as I've forgotten all about this too. It's so amazing. You're making me, I'm just like, memories are coming back, things I'd forgotten. But, you know, it really, for them, you know, it was giving birth and being present at a birth was a very high spiritual experience. And midwifery in and of itself, highly respected profession. To the point that, you know, there was a time when I considered becoming a midwife. It had that much influence on me. So, yeah, I felt that very, very strongly. I would say the food, I would say Stephen as their leader, the high level of spiritual consciousness around respect for animals and human life, and maybe that inclusive in the birthing experience, and probably the having of children in the farm, you know. the respect that they had for children, despite some kind of inconsistencies that I felt like I saw, was probably a lot of the glue that held it together. Yeah.
When was the, you said sometimes they would go into town to get products that were foreign to the farm, but when was like the first interaction of the children to the outside world?
You know, I can't really answer that. I don't really know. I really don't know about that. I think that they maybe did. It seemed to me that the children were left behind on purpose so that they wouldn't go into town and, you know, be asking for things that they couldn't have, and, you know, so the shopping trip would be more focused and concentrated. But on the other hand, it did seem like that there were kids that did get to go into town with their parents. I don't know. That's a really good question. Do you have any idea about that from anything that you've heard? Or do you, Deb? I don't know. The teachers even seemed to come from the farm, you know, were residents of the farm at the school. I don't think that they were, like, heavily trying, I don't think they were trying to protect their children from learning about town. It just seemed like the farm, you know, provided so much that there wasn't that much need. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Good question.
Was there anything from your experience there that you feel that you brought forward into your life now, like when you came back to Lawrence? Maybe ways that you were cooking or ways that you were interacting with people, anything like that?
I don't think at first there was.
Mm-hmm.
As the years have gone by, I've gotten a lot more nostalgic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in retrospect, I'm nostalgic now about the farm, and I wasn't at first. When I first left, I was so angry with them about the way that I saw them dealing with their children, particularly, that I really didn't have a good feeling. You know, I was ready to leave, wanted to go, and just kind of didn't want to remember, honestly, and I'm sorry to say that. But I think over time, you know, I've been able to look back and appreciate the effort, for one thing, you know. And I think that I have been influenced by the value systems. You know, the attempt to live only on what you grow and only on season, in what's in season, is actually a macrobiotic principle. And I became macrobiotic for a period of time just in the last few years and understood a lot more of what that was about and came to respect it. I think that, you know, the whole birthing experience, I will say, was so positive for me, you know, that I could never ever think of any of having a child other than at home. And never would I want to enter a hospital and have a child delivered by any other than a midwife either. The bonding between the women, I think, had a real powerful effect on me and has continued through the years that I've lived here in Lawrence. And the communal experience has continued for me here. I came back and continued to be active in the mercantile and tried to start actually a communally owned and operated restaurant, Sister Kettle.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Sister Kettle? I was one of the planning and first participating members of Sister Kettle as well. I named it. That was my name.
Okay.
And I've always been a member of the credit union and continue to be a member of the mercantile. I'm real community active now in the job that I have. I'm a Vista volunteer, and I love to do outreach. And I love being a resource person for anyone that needs any kind of help. So I think, you know, and also, you know, really feeling what it's like now to have lived in a town for a number of years versus the feeling that I had living in those cabins, you know, on the farm. I often wish I could go back, you know, now, because I love the idea of living in the outdoors and kind of roughing it a little bit, you know. So, And there's probably more. You know, as I look at these pictures, I just think, wow, what a place, you know? I mean, they did everything themselves, you know? Everything themselves. Except, you know, like there were, I mean, they couldn't like manufacture cleaning products on the farm, you know? But, you know, there's a few things that they had to buy, but I mean, just what a concept, what an idea, you know? And I'm glad to know that it's still going, and I know for a fact that, you know, Jim Cooley, who has the tofu factory here in town, right down there by the behind Jay Hood, he gets his tempeh cultures from the farm. And I don't know, do you know if he visited there, if he learned how to make his tofu from there? But I think he follows their recipe. And I remember going and watching them make tofu on the farm, and he used to make his tofu just like they do there, and I think still does. So, yeah. One thing I remember, this is a funny story. This is really off of any subject, but you know, at the time that I was there, most of the guys had beards. And I remember asking one of them one day, you know, it's so hot, you know, why don't you shave it off? And I remember them saying, well, we like to have our beards long because the wind blows through and cools us when we're working out in the fields as we sweat into our beards. And so right. Now if I see a guy with a long beard in the summer, I always think of that, you know. And another thing that I'd remembered that I'd forgotten was, you know, out of their respect for animals, they wouldn't ever keep pets. And I distinctly, and I still remember, and I have this written in a notebook. I kept a notebook for a while I was there. And one of the first things that I wrote was, you know, I think it's really cruel of them that they don't allow us to feed the cats that are here, because I always had cats, you know, for my pets before I went there. And I just didn't understand how they could turn away a hungry, meowing cat, you know, that would come to the door. There were lots of them. They kept them for mice, you know, for mouse catchers. But because they felt that animals, you know, were creatures of the wild and belonged there, they never had any pets, not pet dogs or pet cats. Any of the animals that you saw would remain wild and not fed, you know, by the humans in the households. And that did have a big effect on me for a long time.
That's changed.
Has it? They now have pets.
Now pets, and in fact, it's like everywhere else, I think it's a big bone of contention, you know, what's your dog doing in my garden?
You have a question?
So plows and so forth were human push?
No, they had, in fact, I have a really, this one of my pictures here is, no, they had farm equipment. They had bulldozers and tractors. See, here's one of their dozers. And they had to keep those around because the dirt roads on the farm were nasty in the summertime, real dusty, you know, so they'd go down periodically and wet them down and, you know, doze them down and then put gravel on them. No, they used motorized farm equipment. Most of it was pretty old, but, you know, good stuff.
They tried horses for just a very brief time, just when they started.
Yeah, the horse-drawn plow with the people going behind him. Yeah, what was
they,
the story?
Well, they
on
immediately
that?
Figured out that wasn't going to get it. That they needed a whole lot bigger operation than that.
Uh-huh.
They had tractors within a year, I think.
Yeah, I seem to remember that. And wasn't there something too about they really didn't want to use the horses as, or was that right? They didn't mind using them for work. They didn't mind using the animals for work as their work companions, but they just didn't want them to be pets.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask one other question I meant to earlier and forgot. You've talked of singles and couples and such. What kinds of rules or expectations were there for sexual behavior?
Oops. That's my uncomfortable topic. Especially in front of my kid. Are you game for this? Are you going to be okay if I talk about this?
I'm fine.
Okay.
we're just talking abstractly about what their policies were.
In a public place. frankly, I think that couple behavior was pretty spontaneous, and that was why the couples each had their own room. Each couple, if they were a couple, they had their own bedroom space. that wasn't just that was just for their use, not shared by another couple.
Okay, but I guess my question is, were you supposed to couple up and stay monogamous, and was it a structured?
Well, see, that's a good question. That was one of the little arguments that was going on at the time about Stephen and Ina May. There, it seemed that there was some kind of a discussion, or like, how can I put this? Trying to be tactful. Sorry, tape recorder.
Well.
There was a rumor going around that Stephen and Ina May were having a non-monogamous relationship with another woman in their household. And it seemed to me that there were some people on the farm who were wanting to conduct similar relationships but were forbidden from doing so.
Really? Yeah.
It seemed that way.
Well, I can tell you officially what the deal was. There was a period early on of what they called four marriages, two couples. And there were, I think Stephen and Ina May were in a four marriage. And there was,
That's right.
And they went beyond that to a few six marriages as well.
Yeah, where like there would be three women and three men,
yeah.
And all the partners would share
right.
with each other, and sexually as well.
Yeah, and that was, I think, fairly early in the history of the farm, and it apparently was fairly disastrous, and they closed it down and disavowed it, and that was, you know, ancient history. But it may have been that was still going on when you were there.
There were little touches of something going on.
Okay.
There were. I remember, but I can't really be too specific. I just know that there were some couples that were divided on the issue and were living separately, you know, because of it and because of their feelings about Stephen.
Hmm.
That's all I can tell
okay.
you.
Okay.
What were some of the other complaints against Stephen that was separating the group?
There weren't any others that I can recall. It just seemed to be his politics. His politics and his value system. And the fact that he really seemed to... He domineered. I think that was the big problem, you know, that... He had some real specific ideas about how he wanted people to lead their lives and live. And if they didn't agree with him, then it was trouble. But what those specific ideas were, I can't tell you. And frankly, you know, if you can get a hold of this book, this actually was really the first way that I found out about the farm, I think, even before I met with the midwives. There used to be a book called Caravan. Do you have a copy of that book? That's a good source of information about how the farm was run and about Stephen Gaskin and about how he got the people together on school buses and brought them down to Summertown and got them to start the farm. Talks a lot more about him and who he is and what he's like, I think, than probably, would you agree, anything that's been published since?
Probably. Mm-hmm.
So maybe Tim could bring that book in and show it to you and you could talk about that.
Yeah, we're going to get to that later in the semester and look at pictures and all. Yeah.
I'd love to have a copy of that, too. Do you have a book catalog? Do you know if they're still
publishing it? They still sell most of Stephen's books by mail, yeah.
Do they?
Yeah.
If you wouldn't mind, I'd like to.
I can get you one, sure.
Okay, that'd be great. Thanks.
I do business with them regularly.
To look through.
Well, do you have any other memories or anything that... you'd like to tell us before we give this all up?
I think I've probably shared a lot more than I ever intended to.
I have one more question.
Okay.
Well, actually two, but one question is, you say that there were women, this is back to division of labor again, there were women who went and worked in the fields with the men.
Uh-huh.
Were there ever men who stayed at home and did the laundry and the cooking and taking care of the children?
It's possible. I do remember one guy in particular that seemed to be doing that, and it seemed to me that he was this woman's husband. I remember his name was Tim. He was really sweet. So yeah, there were a few.
Okay.
And I will say too that it does seem to me that the women that would go out and work were single. The women that would work in the fields were single women. I don't recall that there were married women that would go out and work in the fields. However, it does seem to me that the married women, if more income was needed, might be the ones that would go into town and find jobs, like secretarial jobs.
I think they actually had people drive all the way to Nashville, didn't they, just to...
Yeah, see, I'm thinking, I'm not just thinking Summertown. When I mean into town, I mean larger city. Yeah, that's right, Nashville.
They needed the money.
Yeah, they did. They did.
Last question. I would like to hear your impression, not the books or anything else, but what was your impression of Stephen and his teaching and his position that you haven't covered already?
Well, the reason I didn't go to the Sunday meetings was because I thought he had an incredibly huge ego, and it really turned me off, in short. That's my impression.
Anyone have any last questions? Well, thank you very much, Marilyn. We appreciate it, even for coming in. That's been quite enlightening, and we thank you. And the people of the future who want to know the history of this magnificent era, well, thank you for making this tape.
Okay. You're welcome.